Hi, Mom.
Hey, Jenna. Well, welcome back to Catching Up on Crime.
Yeah, I'm excited. You've been wanting to do this podcast for a while, this episode. So I'm sure you've got lots of information by now to share with us.
Well, I hope so. And the thing is I struggle with moving on to my next podcast and researching it until I have one recorded, because then in my mind I get them all mixed up. So needed to get this one recorded so that I can start, you know what I mean? The research on my next one.
Yeah, you tried pawning this podcast off to other people. I know, you don't have to make excuses.
Well, you seemed too busy for me, so I thought maybe someone else would have the time of day. But clearly,
I'm never too busy for my mama. What? More for true crime. I will admit, though, I haven't been watching or listening to any true crime, and I really do want to get back into it because I feel like I have to take breaks sometimes from it. It gets to be a lot. But now that I want to get back into it, you know, my Netflix is no longer recommending any true crime. Like, because before, when I was watching it a lot, I would get great recommendations on my Netflix. So now I'm not. But so,
yeah, I don't know. I've kind of been liking like the Accident channel and different other channels, I guess. You know, true crime is really, has it always been out there? Or I don't know. I just feel like everywhere you look, there's true crime, true crime, true crime. Everybody's obsessed. Everybody wants to know. Yeah. I guess they all want to be like us, Jenna.
Ain't that the truth? If anyone has any recommendations, I'll gladly take them. So the thing that I've been watching on Hulu is called Big Sky, and it's actually not true crime. It's just, it's described as police procedural. I don't know. It's on AMC, or I'm sorry, ABC. The only reason I like it is because A, it's pretty fast. Like it's not slow to tell the story. And it's also, I think it's written by the same guy who did Big Little Lies, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I saw that. I haven't seen the show, but I saw the previews for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but I guess it's not true crime. It's just a thriller.
It's just crime.
Okay, Mama, why don't we get into today's case?
All right, I'm excited. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay, Jenna, so today I'm going to bring you the story of Eddie O'Brien. Have you ever heard of the story of Eddie O'Brien? 15-year-old? Okay. Most of the information I'm going to give to you today comes from the book, The Politics of Murder by Margot Nash. But I also did some research from Boston Magazine and the New York Times. So this is the story of Eddie O'Brien. So on Sunday morning, July 23rd, 1995, Eddie awoke at 6:30 in the morning as he had to be to work at 7. After he worked, his sister gave him a ride home and he went back to bed and slept for a few hours. Eddie then got up and left the house with his sister at 5:30. He went back to the convenience store to talk to some people until 6:30. So the convenience store is where he worked. He went back to that place, talked to like his coworkers, probably kind of slash friends, until 6:30, where he then went to the park and headed home. He saw his best friend, Ryan Downing, and two other friends outside Ryan's house, which was right across the street from Eddie's house. They hung out together until about 8 o'clock that night. At that time, his friends all left to go swimming. Eddie was kind of sensitive about his size because he was a pretty big boy. He was kind of what they call a chubby pre-adolescent. So he chose not to go with his friends. And this was pretty normal, according to his friends, that he didn't like to go swimming. And so when he chose not to, that was not something unusual. So he walked back across the street to his house, where he sat with his dad and sister on the front porch. Now, Paul Downing, which was Ryan's twin brother, came home while he was sitting on the porch and then left with Eddie's sister to go swimming as well. They left at around 8:30 p.m. Paul Downing later told the police that when he came home during this time, that his mother was sleeping on the couch and he closed the front door, which automatically locked. So that's kind of important as we get into the story. So around 9:15, Eddie decided to go get something to eat at Burger King. As he left, he decided to stop by Ryan's to see if his friends had returned home. When Eddie knocked on his friend's door, he heard a loud bang and thought someone had fallen. Eddie slowly opened the door and saw blood on the stairs and in the front hall. The bathroom door was closed. He then saw Janet Downing, his best friend's mom, lying on the floor. He ran to her and realized there was blood all around her. He was confused as to how this could have happened from just a fall. So he turned her over and saw that there were many cuts on her neck. He shook her, but she would not wake up. He stood up to go to the door and saw a tall man with dark hair and dark clothes, who had on a nylon stocking over his head and face, between him and the door. He held a knife to Eddie's throat and said, "If you say anything, I'll kill you and your family, and I will have time before the police catch me. Now get the fuck out of here." He turned to run out the back, and in order to do this, he had to go through the basement. So Eddie, of course, couldn't get out the front door, so he turned around and went to the basement. He remembered the basement's door being wide open, which was unusual because not only are doors to the outside usually shut, but he knew Janet always kept this door locked. And it was not locked, and in fact, again, it was wide open. He remembers falling into a bush outside and made his way to Hamlet Street. He thought he heard a voice call out to him, but he was so scared that he just kept going. He was terrified and fully believed this man was going to hurt him and or his family. He never considered calling the police. He felt he had just no choice but to stay silent. So at this point, Eddie continued to go to Burger King. He went to the bathroom, washed his face, and when he left Burger King, he said two teenagers confronted him demanding money and flashing a knife at him. He gave them the only money he had, which was only $17, and then he went to the convenience store again where he worked. It was there that he realized his hand was cut. To this day, he says he does not remember how or when he got cut. He told his friend at the store that he had been jumped by someone, and the clerk called the police. When the EMT arrived, they bandaged his right hand. He had a cut in the top of his crease of his pinky, another fleshy pad on his palm, which was about an inch, and then right above his thumb, down towards the palm of his hand. The police then drove him home from the convenience store. After arriving home, his grandfather, who was there, wanted him to go to the hospital. And while at the hospital, police arrived and asked for a swab of dried blood from his shin. Eddie and his father were taken in for questioning that night. Eddie's clothes and shoes were seized. His fingerprints were taken, and early the next morning, he was released to his father's custody. He would formally be arrested the next day. He was charged with first-degree murder. Eddie was just 15 years old at the time.
Okay, so wait. So Eddie is the overweight boy that didn't go swimming?
Yes.
And when he went to go check to see if his friends had come home from swimming, he saw his best friend's mother dead.
Right.
But then him and his father were called in? Oh, because he's a minor?
Yes, because he's only 15 years old. Yep.
Wait, what about his twin brother? His twin brother went swimming with him? Or swimming with the kids?
Yes. Ryan is the one that had the twin brother. Ryan, his best friend.
Oh, so the mother of the twins is the one who just died.
Right. So Eddie didn't tell the police or his father that what he had seen that night. He didn't tell them for 2 weeks. After Eddie was in custody for 2 weeks, he wrote his attorney telling him he had, in fact, been in the house. His attorney arranged for him to undergo a forensic interview under sodium amytal. This is like a lie detector. It is useful, but it's not admissible in court. However, the test indicated that Eddie was being truthful. When the police seized Eddie's clothes and his shoes, he had on the same clothes that he had been seen wearing throughout the day. So again, he went to work, he came home, he went back to work at the convenience store just to talk to some of his coworkers. And during that whole time, he had on the same clothes as he did when the police seized them or took them. And photos show that there was no visible blood on his clothes. He did, however, have visible scratches on his shin where they took the swab of blood. And this was from the bush that Eddie remembered falling into. This neighborhood that Eddie and Ryan, ultimately his best friend who lived, again, right across the street from each other, was a close family-oriented neighborhood. People helped each other out and they cared about each other. So Gina Mahoney was a friend of Janet Downing's, Ryan's mother, who's also the victim. She recalls Janet telling her if something were to ever happen to her, to make sure the police investigated, even if it looked like an accident.
That's sus.
Yeah. So when Janet told Gina this, Gina, of course, asked why and was told that she, Janet, was afraid of Artie. Artie and Janet's sister, along with their baby, lived with Janet for about a year. So Artie is Janet's brother-in-law. Janet found out that he was dealing drugs out of her basement, and therefore she kicked them out. Janet stated clothing would be moved in her house, Christmas decorations would be found randomly in rooms, and Janet shared also that someone had poured windshield washer fluid all over her car interior, seats, and rugs. She also showed her a book that she was reading entitled A Guide for Divorced Women. This was Janet. She was reading this book, and later she told her that the book went missing, and she absolutely knew that it was on her nightstand. A couple of days later, Janet's brother-in-law, Artie, again, Artie Ortiz, showed up outside her work and gave her the book. So Janet knew for certain, for a fact, that Artie had been in and out of her house and that he probably still had a key to her house from when he lived there. Gina, at this time, encouraged her friend to go to the police, but she wouldn't because she was afraid they would think she was crazy, and she also didn't want her ex-husband to take her back to court for custody of the kids. Virginia Reckley and her husband were neighbors to Janet. In fact, they lived in a duplex, so they actually shared a wall with Janet and her family. At 8:15 that night, Virginia was changing her granddaughter. She remembers looking at the clock, so she is certain of the time. She was right on the other side of Janet's stairs. And remember back to the story that Eddie said is he saw blood on the stairs right away. So both her and her daughter, Virginia and her daughter Christine, heard a loud boom and both thought that someone had fallen down the stairs on the other side. They continued to listen and heard nothing more, so thought it was okay. The daughter and granddaughter left shortly before 9 p.m. and Virginia went to do the dishes, but she had no water pressure. This happens when someone on the other side or someone in the other duplex is using a lot of water. She doesn't know the exact time that Eddie's dad ran by yelling for help, but believes it had been around 9:30. They ran next door and saw Janet lying on the floor. She noticed the hallway bathroom sink was running with water coming over the sink. So this is why they had no water pressure on their side. Ryan came in and she immediately took him back outside. Virginia, nor her daughter, nor her husband were ever interviewed by the police. It was not until 2 weeks before the trial to testify for Eddie, more than 2 years later, that the DA interviewed her. Okay, so Gina knew something was wrong with her friend when she noticed police and ambulance lights at her friend's house. From reports, she watched her friend's home and then saw Artie walking from Hamlet Street towards her. So again, Artie is the brother-in-law, and she noticed that he was walking towards her. When he got close, she noticed that he looked like he just stepped out of the shower, and he said his dispatcher had radioed him to tell him his sister-in-law had been murdered. Gina was confused by this because the EMT was still inside Janet's home. Janet looked over and noticed Artie's green cab parked the wrong way on Hamlet Street, and it was blocked in by a fire engine, police car, and ambulance. This could only mean that the car was there before the first responders arrived. Artie then started patting his pockets, saying, "Oh shit, oh shit." He then took off running towards Janet's house, stating he had lost his car keys. Janet watched as Artie searched around the yellow tape, now around the house, around his cab, and then in Janet's lawn, where a cop stopped him. He came back to Gina's porch and just kept talking about how he had to find those keys and was very upset he could not go over to Janet's to look for them. Eventually, Artie's cab was towed. Artie remained upset as he stated, "This is really bad. This is really bad. I'm fucked now." The jury would never hear any of this information as well, as these statements were deemed inadmissible hearsay by Judge James McDonald. As when the police talked to Gina the day after Janet's murder, they asked only two questions of her. When was the last time you saw Janet Downing, and when did she leave your house? She tried for 2 years to tell what she saw, but nobody wanted to hear or listen to her. She was told over and over again, they all had the information they needed. So I'm just going to kind of go back to Eddie. So again, Eddie's this 15-year-old kid who, by all accounts, has never been in trouble, is not a troubled kid, comes from a fairly good family. He, you know, attends the Catholic school. He babysits for his neighbor kids. He loves sports. And he had a job at the Midnight Convenience Store. So it is hard to believe, you know, that Eddie did this and did not get a single drop of blood on his white shirt, green shorts, and black sneakers. Because not only did he not get any blood on these clothes, he was wearing a white t-shirt. Now, I get a little confused by that, though, because I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate, I guess, to that. Because, so, the defense is saying that's a good thing, okay? Which I understand. Usually when you don't have blood on you, that's a good thing. However, Eddie did admit to going into the house and turning her over, and that there was a lot of blood around him, or that there was a lot of blood around her. So even if he didn't commit the crime, I don't know how he couldn't have gotten blood on him if that's true. Does that make sense?
Were there footprints or anything?
No, not that. I never saw anything about footprints.
Yeah, so that would be strange because you would think he would leave footprints if there was a, you know, she's laying in a pool of blood, but.
Right. You think he'd have to have blood somewhere there on his mm-hmm. clothing of some kind. But again, the defense is saying that, you know, how could he have done this if he has no blood, which I get, but I'm still a little confused by that. So I'm going to go into the evidence that they have against Eddie. Okay. Eddie's friend, Marco, he's a friend of both Eddie's and Ryan's, stated that he stopped at Ryan's home at 9:20, the night of the murder. No one answered, so Marco went to the back of the house and he heard a rustle in the bushes. He stated he saw a 6'2", 220-pound white man go onto Hamlet Street. He stated he could not 100% positively identify the man. That's what he stated at first. And then later he stated it was Eddie. There's some confusion, and not really confusion, but like he stated it wasn't Eddie, and then later on when Eddie wouldn't return his calls or something like that, then he stated, yeah, it was Eddie. So my question there is, people saw Eddie up to 9:15 p.m. Like, there's several people that saw him at his home at 9:15 p.m., and that's kind of when he said he left, and then he walked over to Ryan's house. If you got 9:15 that he left and Marco arriving at 9:20 saying he's already in the backyard, you know, this was 5 to 15 minutes, maybe, you know, give him 15 minutes. Is that really enough to commit this crime? So Eddie's blood was also found in 4 places in Janet's house: inside the inner front door, the right door jamb of the dining room, the wooden post at the bottom of the basement stairs, and on a pink dress that was hanging up in the basement. His left thumb, index finger, and middle finger prints were found on the bottom of the basement stairs, and prints were also found on the inside of the front door. Eddie also owned 2 3-inch single-edge blade knives with a 4-inch handle. One was red and one was green. They had belonged to Eddie's grandfather, and Eddie had shown them to his friends as well as co-workers. The red knife was found in the trash at Eddie's home. The green one was never found. The reason this is important is that there is a piece of metal found by Janet's stairs, and police believe this was broke off of the murder weapon and would fit Eddie's green penknife, is what they called it. These two knives are called penknives. This piece of metal or hilt was not sent for testing until 2 years later. It came back with primary source of DNA as female and secondary that of a male, but the male was not Eddie. It was never compared to anyone else's DNA. Medical examiners testified that many of Janet's wounds were more than 3 inches. In fact, they were 4 to 5 inches long. So the only way a 3-inch blade could do this is if it were pushed really hard into someone, and then that would cause bruising, which was not present on Janet. Also, Eddie's knife had a hilt left on that would have completely prevented this. Also, one of the stab wounds in her right shoulder was 7/8 of an inch wide, and Eddie's missing green knife was only 3/8 of an inch wide. This was kind of a big deal, was these knives, because again, he had shown them to people knew he had them, but again, there is so much evidence saying that these knives could probably not have been the murder weapon. The DA stated at trial that no other fingerprints but Eddie's were found at the scene. A report from the state crime lab later listed 7 additional prints. 3 were identifiable, but not Eddie's. The other 4 had insufficient detail, so they could not figure out whose they were. You know, again, kind of want to go to the spot of why would Eddie's prints not be there? That's not a red flag for me. If this is his best friend, he's been over into the house multiple times.
Right.
I don't understand how they didn't think they were going to find Eddie's fingerprints there.
Well, you know, he never said he wasn't there. So, I mean.
Right. And then you have these 7 additional prints, you know, and 3 were not Eddie's. I don't know. I guess I'm not. I know fingerprints can lead you to something, but if you came into my house right now, you'd probably find people's fingerprints somewhere in my house. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, are you throwing lots of parties?
Well, I do have people that come in my house. So.
Yeah. Did they ever match any fingerprints to anyone else?
No.
Did they try?
No.
Yeah, that's strange.
And one of the last things of evidence that I'm going to talk about right here is that Eddie had typed AB blood on his right shin, you know, when they swabbed his shin there. Now, this is a rare blood type. However, Janet, Ryan, and Paul, as well as Artie, all had type AB blood. So even though this is a rare blood type, it doesn't rule out any of them as suspects. The reason I brought up the blood type is because we already have one, I believe, possible other suspect, and that's Artie, her brother-in-law. I think it's very suspect, this story that her friend says about him being there that night, him saying that his dispatcher told him she was dead when I don't even think she was even out of the house yet, her body. So I get that in smaller towns, things can spread fast, but that's a little bit too fast. And clearly, you know, his cab being there blocked in by all the emergency vehicles means he was there before they were. So he's a suspect to me right away. But there also becomes another suspect, and that's where kind of the blood comes in too. And that is Paul Downing Jr. So remember, Paul Downing Jr. was Ryan's twin brother, but he was a grade higher due to Ryan being held back. Therefore, Paul had different, you know, set of friends. As he stated, he, you know, had several friends, and he was friends with Eddie's actual older sister. That's who he went swimming with that night. So he stated that he, along with his friends, came home at 8:15 to change clothes and go swimming. This is the same time neighbors said they heard noises from the stairs. When Paul and his friends arrived home that night around 11:15, Paul stated when he saw the lights, "Oh my God, it's my mother. Something happened to my mother." The police did not interview Paul until a day later, and by that time, Eddie was already in custody. Paul was the last person to see the victim alive and the only other person home when the noises were heard, but he was only interviewed for 10 minutes. So remember the neighbors who heard the noises that sounded like someone falling down from the stairs. Mm-hmm. That was at the time that Paul would have been home changing his clothes. He also, if you remember way back to when I said something about the locked door, he said that when he left, he shut the door and it automatically locked.
Right.
So there was no way Eddie could have gotten in that door, just opened that door.
Right.
So if you're to believe all of this, it's just, again, I guess I lean somewhat towards Artie because Janet believed he had a key to the house. So again, the police didn't interview Paul until the next day. And it was like a 10-minute interview. There was also a backpack of items of Paul's taken. That group of items there was a knife. There was also hair in the palm of Janet's hand that was never DNA tested. But it was stated at trial that they were consistent with that of Janet and Paul Downing. We have a knife that we know that Paul had but was never found. And we have hair that could have been Paul's. We have blood that could have been Paul's. And none of that was really even looked into. Okay, so the last thing you know, it's in these crimes, you usually want to come up with a motive of why the crime happened. And there did not seem to be any motive for this. What the DA did come up with as a motive, and we'll kind of discuss that as we move into other things, but it was that Eddie was obsessed with Janet Downing, that he kind of was a sexual psychopath, and he finally snapped and went after her. The reason they got there is a little bit slim. I don't know what the word is to me. So they said these are statements that Eddie had made to either Ryan or, you know, a few of his friends. One of the statements was, Eddie must have said, "Why is your mother always sitting in the driveway when she comes home from work?" He asked him, "Why is his mom always going to Jean's house?" It also came out that Eddie was not the only one that kind of questioned this. And it was all in kind of no big deal kind of a manner. Like, Janet came home, often would just kind of sit in her car. And so Eddie and his friends asked about it. Mm-hmm. Not a big deal. To me, that does not cry out obsession. Okay. Mm. So at one time, though, Eddie did ask, "Is your mother gay or lesbian?" He also told Ryan that her cooking was bad. And then I believe it was earlier that very day, he had made a comment to Ryan of, "Have you ever felt like hurting someone?" Again, I don't think any of those comments drive me to go to that motive whatsoever. He did make the comment too that he had watched the neighbor lady change in front of her window. Yeah, that might in itself kind of be like, you know, whatever. But I guess we do have to remember he's a 15-year-old kid. And it also came out that Marco, one of his friends that testified, the one that came to the house at 8:20 and went around back and saw him, Marco was also present when that happened. They were on Eddie's front porch and they were both present. I guess I'm going to kind of throw it out there that doesn't hold water with me either as a motive. Okay. So Jenna, now I'm going to get into what I actually really liked about this case. You know me, I kind of like the legal part of things and cases that have different legal things going on. I'm going to talk about the legal system. Again, this is why this case is so super interesting to me. The juvenile justice system was based on educational, social, and clinical services to kids adjudicated delinquent. So kids who got in trouble, the goal of the juvenile justice system was basically to educate them or to give them services to turn their life around, so to speak. Kids younger than 17 should be treated differently than adults. That was, you know, the theory. These kids are impulsive and often not able to consider the consequences of their actions. Their brains are not fully developed, and therefore rehabilitation was used more than incarceration. So before 1991, a kid between 14 and 17 could be tried as an adult if the offense, if done by an adult, was punishable by prison versus county jail, and they had previously been found delinquent. Again, I want to reiterate that this happened in 1995. The beginning 1990s found politicians and legislators switching to more of a punishment versus rehabilitation. So like between 1991 and 1995, when Eddie entered the system, there was a growing movement of people who believed that our inner cities were about to become war zones for a juvenile population of, quote, super predators. So like super predators, have you ever heard of that term, Jenna?
No, I haven't.
That is an actual, I don't know if they made it a legal term, but there was a lot of legislation and politicians who would use that term. Two people who were strongly committed to super predator laws were Massachusetts Governor Weld and Thomas Riley, the district attorney. On July 26, 1995, Thomas Riley attended Eddie's juvenile hearing and declared he himself would be personally trying the case. Now, the reason that's significant is because it's so uncommon. It had never been done before in this county, in fact. The largest county in New England, Massachusetts, and the DA had never done that. which if you're thinking, well, why wouldn't a DA do that? The DA has lots of assistants, DAs underneath them, and that's who try the cases. If you remember watching Law and Order with me every single day, if we could, you know, there's always the DA who's kind of the head guy, and then there's the assistant DAs underneath him, and they're the ones that are trying cases. The head DA does right. not. So this was really uncommon. So this elected district attorney had over 250 assistant district attorneys. Like I said, normally they try the cases and they just get the oversight from the DA. Many looked at this as a move to position himself to run for state attorney general. One thing for certain was people would be looking at this case for juvenile reform or super predator debate, of which the DA, Thomas Riley, was leading. The stakes were very high for both the Governor Weld, who was now running for U.S. Senator, and the DA, Tom Riley. Riley had to succeed in getting a conviction on Eddie, but not in juvenile court. He needed that conviction to be in adult court. At the first hearing to see if Eddie should be moved to adult court, Dr. Barnon, a very respected adolescent forensic psychiatrist, met with Eddie for 7 hours. He met Eddie's family. He talked to Eddie's doctors, teachers, coaches, and staff from the correctional facility. He also had a full psychological testing completed. His conclusions were that he was cognitive and emotionally functioning was like that of a preteen or early adolescent. He had no prior court involvement. He had no report of abuse. He had no conduct or disciplinary problems at school. He was involved in school activities and had good peer relationships. One of the parts of this psychological is to determine if treatment could be effective. There had been no treatment offered to Eddie during his time in the correctional facility or the juvenile facility to this point. So this doctor didn't really make mention of that other than it wasn't offered yet. In the end, it determined if Eddie was a candidate for rehabilitation. Dr. Barnum stated Eddie did not currently present with any clear psychiatric disorder for which treatment is indicated, and his successful treatment was in all likelihood good. The DA presented only facts about the case, nothing about Eddie himself, and why he could not be rehabilitated if, in fact, he committed this crime, which was, after all, the purpose of this hearing. 2 weeks after Dr. Barnum's report, DA Riley gave him information that Eddie had stolen money from his grandfather and from Janet Downing. This was never verified and was never raised at trial. Eddie was once questioned regarding a burning mailbox, but was never charged. So DA Tom Riley brought in two psychiatrists who talked about how the crime was suggested the perpetrator was sexually driven. Neither psychiatrist interviewed Eddie. They provided no evidence of sexual, violent, or sadistic behavior in Eddie's past or present. However, this gave way for the DA's theory for motive that Eddie was a sexual, sadistic predator who had hidden this dark side. So this hearing was basically, again, just on whether he could be rehabilitated. And we have a psychiatrist who spends a lot of time with Eddie and the people around him who say, yes, they believe treatment could benefit him. And then we have other people who are basically saying, no, you know, he's a sexual predator and can't be rehabilitated. And yet they never met him, never talked to him, never talked to anybody else. So this hearing took 9 days, and the judge took 15 days to render his decision that Eddie was amenable to rehabilitation in the juvenile justice system and ordered him to be returned to juvenile court. If found guilty, and now in juvenile court, Eddie would serve his sentence in a youth facility getting treatment until he turned 21. He would then serve 15 years in adult prison. This is what was called a split sentence. So basically, because he was 15, he could be charged and serve part of it in juvenile and then the rest of it in adult. Riley could not accept this, however, so he filed a notice of appeal on February 1996. On June 1 of 1996, Governor Weld called on the Senate to pass a bill requiring juveniles charged with murder to always be tried as an adult. And on July 26, 1996, he signed into law mandating that anyone age 14 or older charged with murder must be tried as an adult, and if convicted of first-degree murder, must be sentenced to life without parole. Judge Heffernan later stated that he got called by another judge who was a friend of his and was told if he did not change his decision on Eddie's hearing, he was going to be removed from the case. This was even before Riley filed his appeal. Judge Heffernan stated he would not change his decision. And not long after that conversation, Heffernan was removed as judge from Eddie's case. The appeal took 8 months, and it was decided it needed to go back for some clinical reasons. This time it went to Judge Gailey. At this time, Eddie had been in custody now for 21 months. Obviously, there's a great maturity that happens between 15 years old and basically 17 then. So the second transfer hearing lasted only 5 days. The DA, Riley, brought in several reports that indicated Eddie had a crush and borderline obsession with Janet. And again, most of that is based on those statements that I read to you earlier. Judge Gailey asked Dr. Barnum to update his report. And that's where I say that there's a lot of maturity that happens in between there, because I don't know how you accurately update a report from someone who was 15 at the time they committed the crime to now someone who is 17. In the end, Eddie was ordered to be tried as an adult. Due to all the political implication of Eddie's situation, with new laws literally being created, there was a lot of media attention. As we have talked about before, the media can play a huge role in these trials. In choosing a jury alone, 76 out of the 208 stated they felt he was guilty based just on the media coverage alone. There is little doubt each juror member had some kind of media exposure to this case before they were chosen. Basically, like I said, that's why this case was so interesting to me, is because I do believe the DA had an agenda for this case. I do believe in the things that I read and researched that they were focused on Eddie from the very beginning and really didn't give any time to these other suspects, potential people who could have done it. I don't know. I'm not saying that they did, but it should have been looked into. But they had an agenda. And as this trial went on, this agenda happened. Like, they got the juvenile justice reform that they were looking for. I guess I'm just going to ask you, Jenna, what your thoughts are. I mean, you're obviously a lot younger than me and another generation, but do you think it's okay or warranted that juveniles should be convicted to a life sentence without parole?
No, not really, because I kind of feel like, what is the point of us having this like standard age that it considered that where you're considered an adult, but then, you know, constantly trying to convict minors as adults. Like, I've never really understood that, because like, then why do we have this age? And I get it, because some of them are so close to being 18, but it is 18, right?
Well, 18 is when you become an adult, but in the legal system, you're exactly right. In the legal system, it's not black and white. And I get right. that things don't have to be black and white. And right. I know that there are different crimes that you get different punishments for, but I agree with you. Like, he was 15 at the time of this. And I guess maybe I'm really being motivated by the fact that, if it hasn't come across, I am not even 80% certain that he did this.
Right.
So that does play a role, but I just don't believe in that as a whole. Just like I don't believe in the death penalty. And that's just because our legal system is flawed. There are so many shows on TV today. There are so many cases of people being convicted that didn't do the crime, that we have to know that by now, that there are so many flaws, unfortunately. And I don't know how to fix that. I'm not a scholar of that, but therefore I am against the death penalty. So I just can't be for convicting a 15-year-old to spend the rest of their life in prison without the possibility of parole. I can't be for that.
In terms of a life sentence without the possibility of parole, that's a harsh conviction, especially. And then you factor in that he's only 15. It's like, I don't know. And you hear about so many other people that have done so much worse, and then they get out in like 16 years. So that doesn't really make any sense to me.
So if you haven't figured out too, Eddie was convicted of this crime. He was sentenced to that. Eddie is still in jail. However, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court did declare that life sentences without parole for juveniles was unconstitutional. So that is no more. And I don't know if you remember me talking about a case that I knew where two people were convicted of the crime And one of them was like 18 and 2 months. And then the other one was, you know, under 17 at the time of the crime. And they both got life without parole because they were in that time frame. And then when it was ruled unconstitutional, the one was released because she was not 18.
Oh yeah, right.
And again, that's a weird...
And now you know that my mother is one of those that has a different ringtone for every person in her phone. Who is that?
That was your dad.
Oh.
So I don't know how I feel about that either, because now you have one person who was released and you have another that is going to spend the rest of her life in prison for the same crime, and they were literally only 3 months different in age.
Yeah.
So it's a hard concept. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's why I like to talk about these things, because I think it has to be talked about. It has to be thought about. You know, so many people are so quick to judge and declare that this is the way it should be or that way. And fortunately, I just don't, it's not black and white. I get that. It's not black and white. But I also don't think we can sentence 15-year-olds to life in prison. Also, on the after fact, so Eddie's attorney, Robert George, was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for money laundering in October of 2012. You know, Eddie's attorney didn't look into a lot of things for him. Eddie's attorney didn't follow through on a lot of things. That just kind of shows me that Eddie's attorney was not a very good guy. If he's, you know, money laundering, you know, himself as an attorney, he's not a very good, very good guy. And then Robert Pino, the crime lab administrator, who... You know, there was all these things that weren't submitted to the crime lab and came back different and just, yeah. So anyway, he was the crime lab administrator. He was fired from his job in April of 2007 for DNA that was false. That also doesn't bode well for this DA's, the case here against Eddie. And of course, Tom Riley, the DA in this case, he won his election for Attorney General of Massachusetts in 1998. And he served 2 terms. So he got what he wanted. He used the juvenile reform to gain, I guess you could say, respect from others and people that were looking for that. And he did become the attorney general. So he got what he wanted. Not only did he get Eddie convicted, but he rose in the ranks himself.
Right. What was the name of the guy that Janet was afraid of, her brother-in-law?
Artie Ortiz. Are you looking him up?
Yeah, I just want to see if anything ever happened. Because it also is a little bit strange that, I don't know, if this guy was so peculiar, you would almost think that he would have some kind of history. Oh my God. Eddie was 6'4" and weighed 260 pounds.
When he was just 15. 6'4"? Right. He was a big kid. I think that, too, actually can play a role. When you look at someone that's 15, but they're that big, you don't really consider them that age. But that can't play a role in it because that has nothing to do with his mental development. All right, that's it. That's all, folks.
Wait, hold on. I want to see. This thing said it's a 6-minute read, and I think I've been reading for like 14.
Maybe you read slow.
Oh, this is kind of an interesting little tidbit. It says that in 2013, a ruling by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that juveniles convicted of murder serving a mandatory life sentence should have a chance at parole, meaning Edward's case could go up for a review. However, to be eligible for parole, Eddie would have to confess to the crime.
That's right.
But he refused to do that.
Right.
Which is also so interesting because it's 2013, he's stuck in jail. He knows that, and he's still, you know, you'd almost think that he would lie and say he did it just to get out of jail, but he still won't.
And that is a whole nother thing. Like, why does the justice system, why do they think that's a good thing to put in there?
Right, yeah.
That's like, so you're either enabling people to lie because they didn't do it. It just seems like...
Well, it almost seems like a cover-up, like they want more statistics that prove that they have the actual killer in jail.
Right, because then they can say, hey, we were right, because he confessed. Right. And some people don't look into it further, which I get. We're not all crime junkies like you and I, but you're exactly right. The statistics would then would go up that they were right. And really that's on a technicality, because I think there's many people who would confess to it at this point just to get out.
Yeah. I don't know. That's crazy. I can't find anything on it on Artie Ortiz now.
Well, I know nobody has called me up and asked for my opinion, but Artie, he's a little suspect from the very beginning. And I just can't get over the fact that she knew he was going into her home. His car was blocked in and his keys went missing. And where did he go looking for his keys? Her house. So clearly he had been there that night. You don't go looking for your keys where you've never been.
Yeah.
I'm guessing Artie's laying low because he knows he got away with something. And if you want to know a lot more detail, not really about the story, but more of the politics, I guess, and that's why it's called The Politics of Murder by Margot Nash. I thought it was an interesting book. All right. Well, until next time.
All right. Talk soon.
Bye.
Bye.